This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and I've been bringing you a lot of solo episodes yesterday where I explain a quick legal issue, but I really do want to get a guest in to talk about what's happening in redistricting nationwide. And so today I'm thrilled to be joined by Joseph Axe. He's a national affairs reporter for Reuters. He's been covering many of the redistricting battles throughout the country. So we're going to talk about what's happening in Texas, what's happening in California, what it means for you, even if you don't live in one of those states. Joseph, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for Passing Judgment.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So let's start at the very beginning with kind of what kicked off this redistricting race. I mean, I think I live in California, and it's a big part of our discussion right now because we're about to put a ballot measure on the ballot to vote on redistricting, and we'll get into the details of that. But can you bring us all the way back to what actually is redistricting and why are we talking about it in 2025? Usually it's only once every 10 years after the census.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, President Trump and the White House earlier this summer started making kind of both public and private suggestions to Texas that they consider calling a special legislative session to redistrict their congressional map. And as you said, this is something that typically happens once a decade, right? So congressional districts are based on population. So we do the census once every decade. And after the census comes out, every state has to do a new round of redistricting because they need to make sure that the congressional districts all, you know, kind of represent the same number of people. And in addition to that, sometimes states might gain a district or two. They might lose a district or two as people move about the country. As immigrants move into the country and gain citizenship, so on and so forth. So right off the bat, this is pretty unusual. We do sometimes have mid-decade redistricting, but that's almost always because a court has ordered it, right? Because maybe the previous map was deemed to be illegal for some reason. Maybe it violated the Voting Rights Act and harmed minority voters, something like that. Every now and then, we've seen some mid-decade redistricting where one party has taken power and decided to redistrict to lock that in. So that actually happened in Texas in 2003. Republicans won the legislature. They won the governor's mansion after a long time of Democratic control. And they immediately sought to redistrict because they wanted a map that was more favorable to Republicans. But what we're seeing in Texas this summer, it's basically unprecedented because the current Texas map is already pretty gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. It's a map that was passed by Republican lawmakers only 4 years ago, and that's resulted in Republicans winning 25 of the 38 seats in Texas. And so as far as I know, there isn't really any historical analogy to what we're seeing with one party basically ripping up a map that they passed just a few years ago to install one that's even more extreme. And so once President Trump kind of made it clear this is what he wanted to see, the Republicans in Texas sprang to action. And there's no federal or state law that prohibits them from doing so.
Right. And when we're talking about gerrymandering, we're talking about drawing district lines to essentially, for political gerrymandering, to maintain or increase voting power. For racial gerrymandering, which is something different, racial gerrymandering is still impermissible. And racial gerrymandering is when you draw district lines and it dilutes, I'm being very general here, but dilutes the voting power of racial minorities. It means that it's hard to elect the candidate of your choosing. And of course, we're having this discussion against the backdrop of a House of Representatives that's very, very closely divided. Now, if the House of Representatives was divided by a 30-point swing, I don't think President Trump would have said to Texas, let's go ahead and find five new Republican House members by drawing different district lines, because that five wouldn't make a difference. Now, there was some, you started to talk about this, but there was some drama in Texas when this first happened. Can you remind us what happened when Republicans in Texas said, okay, here's a proposal for new maps? Some people left the state. There were some allegations that they had maybe broken the law. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So several dozen Democrats in the Texas State House fled the state. They went to friendlier states, blue states like New York, Illinois, California. And they did that because in Texas, the state legislature cannot meet and conduct business unless they have a quorum. They have to have at least two-thirds of the members present. And the Democrats have just enough members in the Texas House to deny a quorum if almost all of them leave. And so that's what they did. And it set off really an extraordinary number of recriminations from state Republicans. You had the House Speaker threatening to impose fines, threatening to withhold their pay, signing civil arrest warrants that could be exercised if they were found somewhere in Texas. You had Greg Abbott, the Republican governor, going to court to try to get some of these seats declared vacant under the theory that they had essentially abdicated their responsibilities as legislators. And you had, I mean, so it was really an extraordinary moment. This is not the first time this has happened in Texas. In fact, Democrats did this just a few years ago to try to forestall some other legislation that had to do with voting rights. And, you know, historically, it's been, you know, kind of a temporary solution at best. And that's kind of what we saw here, right? Where Democrats, they managed to stay away until the special session expired. But as governor, Abbott can call as many of these special sessions as he wants. And so he called another one immediately as soon as the first one was set to expire. And the Democrats eventually agreed that they would come back. They felt like they had accomplished what they needed to accomplish, which was to kind of focus a national spotlight on this issue, which they certainly did, right? And to convince Democrats in other states to consider doing retaliatory redistricting to try to make up for what Texas was up to. And so they came back. And, you know, it makes sense, right? Because one thing you need to remember is in Texas, lawmakers, that's not their job. They get a stipend, but they almost all have professional jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've got families. And so, you know, on some level, it's not necessarily reasonable to expect people to leave their homes and their jobs for what could be months and months on end. And so that always seemed like the most likely outcome.
That's a good reminder. And it, of course, led to what I'm living through right now, which is it essentially triggered Governor Newsom to say, we will retaliate. Now, in California, it's not quite as easy to, quote, retaliate as it is in Texas, because we have an independent redistricting commission, and that's actually part of our state constitution. It was added into our constitution first in 2008 via a ballot initiative, and then again in 2010. I know you've been covering this. Do you want to kind of set the table a little bit for what happened when Governor Newsom looked at what was happening in Texas, and he said, okay, Texas, I will see your redistricting and raise you a ballot measure to allow me to redistrict?
When he first suggested this, I think a lot of people viewed it as basically political posturing, right? Especially because everyone knows that Gavin Newsom is probably interested in running for president in a few years. But it became more and more real, I think, as he and other Democrats in California not only were looking at it more closely to figure out, well, could they even do this legally, but also as they watched what really became a pretty galvanizing issue in Texas. So because those Texas Democrats fled the state, because it got so much attention nationally, I think the notion of California basically sidestepping its own independent commission to try to redistrict its congressional lines became a lot more palatable when Democrats saw just how angry Democratic voters were. Not just in Texas, but around the country. And so as you alluded to, it's not that simple in California, right? They can't just draw a map and sign it into law. And so what Newsom has done is he's kind of come up with this legal two-step where the legislature has created a proposed map. They have created a ballot question that will go to the voters in a special election in November. And it basically asks voters to allow lawmakers to redistrict the congressional lines for next year. And then that map would stay in place until the next census, at which point the independent commission would step back in and take its job back. And so it's very explicitly a partisan move, right? But that is a reflection of what Texas did, which was also explicitly a partisan move to help Republicans. And no one's really pretending otherwise, which is also kind of a new aspect of the gerrymandering kind of redistricting wars that we've been seeing.
It is. I love that you highlighted how explicit it is. And I think that's partly a result of the fact that you can't hide what's happening. And partly because the Supreme Court a few years ago now said that allegations that lines are drawn and amount to a political gerrymandering are not justiciable, Joseph, as you know, meaning that that's not a claim you can make in federal court. That's really a claim that you need to make in the political sphere, that you elect people to draw lines. And if you don't like it, maybe the answer is vote them out of office, not bring them to court. And there was a whole host of reasons why the Supreme Court said there wasn't a good standard that they could create to try and judge those political gerrymandering claims. But it does seem to me like it opened the door here for go ahead and say exactly what we're hearing, which is we're doing this to get more Democrats or Republicans in the House. What are you seeing? I know I'm asking this very generally, but what are you seeing play out in California right now? I agree. A lot of people thought maybe this is just posturing. And now we are facing ballot measures that could fundamentally reshape how we draw district lines in California, at least temporarily, to temporarily suspend that. Obviously, there have been some challenges to those ballot measures. Is there something you think is important for people to think about as we're about to, you know, live through potentially a mid-cycle redistricting era in California?
You know, it's an interest. I think it's a really fascinating ballot measure to put before, because as you pointed out before, California voters have already spoken on the issue of redistricting and how they feel about political gerrymandering, right? They've already said, we don't like it and we want to empower an independent commission so that partisan lawmakers can't monkey around with our districts to help themselves, right? And so one thing that's going to be really fascinating is to see how each side approaches it. Because the last time around, the proponents of passing this ballot measure really, you know, talked a lot about the democratic principles at stake, right? And the importance of making sure that gerrymandering doesn't poison the well. This time around, you know, you're going to see folks like Newsom try to make this as much as possible into a referendum on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Right. So he's going to be going around telling voters, basically, you need to vote for this, not because we think partisan gerrymandering is good. Right. We still think it's bad. But we also can't, I think, as they've been saying, unilaterally disarm if Texas and Republicans and other states are going to be kind of using this nuclear option. We need to be able to do that as well. And if you don't vote for this, if you don't let us do this, you're letting Donald Trump and the Republicans continue to hold power in Washington. And so it's really going to be interesting to see if Democratic voters in particular in California are so frustrated and angry about Trump that they're willing to put aside what historically has been an issue that Democrats have pushed much more than Republicans.
I think you're exactly right. From my perspective, this really will be a matchup between people who are very much supportive of the Independent Redistricting Commission, believe that there's kind of an inherent conflict of interest when state lawmakers draw their own district lines and the lines for their colleagues in the House, and people who think, well, that's nice in normal times, but we're not in a normal time here. And we need to temporarily suspend this good government reform. Now, Joseph, you and I were talking a little bit before I pushed record, and I think this is important to remember, but can you emphasize when we're talking about redistricting, and we're talking about gerrymandering, you know, we don't talk enough, I think, about the voters and why, for instance, I skipped over this a little bit, but why an independent redistricting commission might be, at least in the abstract, a good idea.
I mean, I think that's a really good question. You know, folks like me, most reporters, you know, we're focused on the impact of all these redistricting battles on the race for Congress, right? But sometimes the focus on that kind of horse race aspect of it obscures some of the negative consequences that, you know, if people are concerned about protecting kind of participatory democracy, they should worry about, right? So one very obvious one that you kind of alluded to before, which is very much an issue in Texas, is racial gerrymandering. And so the Texas Republicans have said that this is purely partisan. They haven't even looked at race data. But nevertheless, there's already a lawsuit claiming that this map is illegal because it dilutes the power of minority voters, right? It spreads minority voters, voters of color, more thinly over a number of districts and makes it harder for them to elect a candidate of their choosing. And that's partly a reflection of, right, until recently, your race was pretty predictive of how you would vote, right? So if you were trying to take a bunch of Democratic voters in an urban area and kind of crack them into a bunch of different districts, you probably are harming a lot of Black voters too, because there was a lot of overlap between those groups. So that's one really negative potential consequence, right? Another one is, you know, if you think about it, the whole point of gerrymandering is to ensure that there are no competitive districts, right? If you're the power party in power, you know, your goal is to make it so that every district is, so let's say you're a Democratic state and you gerrymander your state, you want to make it so that, you know, let's say the two or three Republican districts are all so Republican that they're won by like 50 points and that you're winning all the other districts by some comfortable margin that you don't need to worry about in a bad year. So, you know, maybe 10, 12, 15 points, something like that. And so the result is that there's fewer and fewer and fewer competitive congressional races. There's 435 districts. Next year, you're going to see probably less than 10% of those be meaningfully contested. And so what happens is, for one thing, you have all these candidates who don't need to worry about whether they're going to win or lose in November, right? All they really need to worry about is whether they're going to win their primary election. And primary voters, primary electorates, are way more partisan, more extreme than the general electorate. And so if you're a Republican who only has to worry about other Republicans, or a Democrat only has to worry about other Democrats, naturally that's going to push you farther right and farther left. And the result of that is more extremism in Congress, more polarization, less opportunity to do anything bipartisan, more opportunity for gridlock. And then the other kind of ancillary downside to that is, if you're a voter and you feel like your vote doesn't matter, why are you going to go vote? Or why are you going to stay politically engaged? And that's what political gerrymandering does, right? Is that the whole point of it is to make individual voters' ballots less valuable and less meaningful. And so if you feel like you go to the ballot box and your vote isn't going to change anything, well, then maybe you stop going and maybe you stop paying attention.
Joseph, I think that's such a good explanation for why we forget this too often, but redistricting really is one of those foundational issues. So to the extent that there's anything you really care about, maybe it's the environment, maybe it's gun control, maybe it's criminal justice, maybe it's privacy rights, that how district lines are drawn will oftentimes dictate who your representative is and therefore which bills get introduced, which bills get voted on, what the vote count is. And we really do need to remember why this is a fight to the political death in so many ways, but also how it affects voters and their daily lives. And I think this is a good moment to ask, we've been focusing on Texas, we've been focusing on California. You gave a really good explanation for what is likely to happen to voters if there's a pretty aggressive gerrymandering. What are you seeing in the rest of the country? What do you see in terms of, are there other states with and without redistricting commissions that are likely to follow? Obviously, a lot of the Democratic states where, you know, what do you need to be a state that follows suit? I think you ultimately need to be dominated by one party, right? The state legislature and the governor have to be controlled by the same party. And there, I think, has to be some ability to redistrict. Maybe you have an independent commission that you have to suspend. And there has to be some ability to redistrict in the sense that there are seats that you could pick up if you draw the lines in a different way. So what are you seeing? I mean, I know people talk about Illinois and New York and Florida. Are there other states we should be looking at here?
Yeah, there's a number of states. I mean, the first one, the most obvious one's probably Ohio, if only because through a kind of a convoluted series of state laws, that's probably too much to get into at this moment. They actually have to draw a new map this year. The map that they used last time has officially expired. And Republicans there control the process. There's a kind of weak commission that's essentially Republican controlled. And so the end result there is likely to be a new map that targets at least two Democrats. That's in a state where Republicans already control, I believe, 10 out of the 15 seats. And so you could see another couple seats there. Appears in Missouri that Republicans there are likely to call a special session to do their own redistricting that would result in targeting at least one Democrat there. Both J.D. Vance and President Trump have met with several lawmakers and leaders in Indiana. So that's another state where they have been encouraging them to redistrict. Again, there's a kind of a single Democratic seat that they could target there. I think you mentioned Florida, right? Ron DeSantis there has made it clear that he'd support redistricting if that's possible. And on the Democratic side, you know, there really aren't a lot of options. I mean, this is part of why I think Democrats have been so worried about this, the floodgates kind of opening here, because, you know, you mentioned New York. There's really no way for them to redistrict before 2028 because they would need to have a constitutional amendment, just like California. But New York has a weird quirk where any constitutional amendment has to pass out of two separate legislative sessions before it can go to the voters. And so it takes a couple years. So you're not going to see any action in New York before 28. And then the other states that people talk about, you know, mentioned Illinois. Illinois already has an extremely gerrymandered Democratic map, and it's not even clear that they could reasonably squeeze another Democratic seat out of it, even if they decided to do it. So the map definitely favors Republicans, and I think that's part of the reason why you've seen President Trump be so aggressive in calling on these states to do this, because I think he recognizes, or at least his advisors recognize, that the Democrats don't have a lot of options to counter this.
Yes. And I do think it's worth emphasizing that we're having this conversation again because it could make a difference when it comes to the balance of power in the House of Representatives. And depending on what is happening in the world in our country at the midterms, you know, who controls the House of Representatives could make an enormous impact on obviously the rest of the Trump presidency.
I mean, I just to, not to interrupt you, but just to put that in context, right? If people have forgotten, last year, Republicans won the House by a margin of three seats, mm-hmm. right? So three mm-hmm. seats flip the other way, and you've got a Democratic speaker, and Trump is being stymied left and right by a Democratic House. So, you know, it may sound like, oh, well, in this state, it's just one seat. In this state, it's just one seat. But when the margins are that thin, and in a country that is this polarized, every little seat can have an enormous, enormous impact. I mean, if you think about all of the things that we've seen out of the current Republican House, I mean, how that would have been so different, and how President Trump's second term would be going very differently if you had a Democratic House. There's just three seats, right? I mean, it's nothing.
It's nothing, and it's everything. I think you're exactly right to emphasize that and highlight it. Joseph, you've been covering this really well for a while now. So I'm just going to end by asking, I think we talked about the most important question, which is how gerrymandering really affects voters and the impact that it can have on people's desire to engage in not just voting, but be engaged members of the electorate. Is there anything else that you hope people understand about this redistricting battle that seems to be kind of on the cusp of sweeping the nation?
You know, I guess a couple things. One is it does feel like so many other things in the Trump era where it's something that was previously, you know, not really done. You know, there are historical norms against it. And then there's a decision by the White House to pursue it. And it turns out that it wasn't done, not because there's really a lot of laws about it, right? But simply because there were kind of political and historical norms. And turns out that you don't need to worry about those if you're a lawmaker and you want to make something happen. And so, you know, that's why we're seeing all of a sudden, not just Texas, not just California, but, you know, half a dozen other states suddenly say, yeah, we're going to jump in on this too. And it's something that you've really never seen before. And so that feels very of the moment of the kind of Trump era to me. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other thing is, you know, we did talk about the impact on voters and on engagement, but, you know, as you mentioned, it has an enormous impact on the types of priorities that these members of Congress bring with them to Washington, right? And so if you are a member of Congress who, you know, only has to worry about the kind of small slice of the primary electorate that's going to make you a nominee every couple years, and then you're going to sail to reelection, you may not necessarily feel much pressure to respond to constituents aside from that small slice, as opposed to someone who, you know, represents a more competitive or a swing district and may feel some pressure or some responsibility to, you know, to reflect the desires of moderate voters, of voters from the other party, and not just the most extreme members of his or her base. And so I think that's a really important point that sometimes gets lost here. It's not just about making these districts more representative and more competitive, but also ensuring that there's a connection between representatives and their constituents.
I think that is a fantastic and important note to end on, which is, again, coming back to, we talk a lot about the horse race and the balance of power, but what's really happening on the ground for the voters and the people and what our priorities are, and all of those things can flow from who our representatives are. So, Joseph, I want to thank you not just for your time, but for your excellent reporting in helping me think through all of these issues and now bringing this information to the listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.